Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences. Itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been 5 days since the United States launched its airstrike campaign against the group ISIS in Iraq. We'll look at what an expert says needs to be done to stop the group.
First, it's been 50 years since the U.S. Surgeon General first released a warning that using tobacco has negative health effects, including an increased risk of lung cancer. Since then, the U.S. government and organizations around the country have launched campaigns focused on getting Americans to quit smoking.
Knowing that smoking is bad for us is one thing. Actually giving it up can be a tall order. The number of Americans who still smoke today is almost 20%. That's about 42 million people, according to the CDC.
The big question for researchers now is, what's the best way to quit? Is it nicotine replacements, gum, maybe hypnosis?
The University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention has recently been charged with trying to figure out an answer to that question. Last month, they received a $12 million grant from the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute to discover best practices for quitting. Megan Piper joins us now. She's assistant professor and lead researcher at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what don't we know about all of these smoking cessation things out there that you're trying to figure out in this new study?
Well, there's a lot, unfortunately, that we don't know. We do know that there are some very effective tools, but we don't necessarily know how to put them together to use them in the best way possible. Plus, we'd like to try and develop some new tools that will be even more effective, perhaps not for everybody, but maybe for particular types of smokers.
And so how are you starting to try to do this?
So what we're trying to do is we're trying to do use a new methodology, a new scientific approach, at least new for us, to try and look at these different treatment components, these different parts of treatment, to try and see which works best and which works best when they're combined together. So in this research, we're going to be looking at treatment for people who want to quit smoking, but we're also going to be looking at treatments for smokers who aren't ready to quit yet. Maybe they're just ready to cut down. Maybe they're ready to take a step towards quitting, but aren't ready to make the big plunge yet.
So that's new to me. Somebody might be in a doctor's office. They smoke. They let the doctor know that they're not ready to quit. How does somebody in healthcare respond to that in a way that might help in the future?
And that's exactly what we're trying to figure out, because right now, if the physician or the clinician says, "Are you ready to quit smoking?" and the patient says, "Not today, doc," then what do we do? Mm-hmm. And right now, most physicians and clinicians aren't ready to answer that question. We know that there are some things you can do, some different motivational techniques you can go to get people thinking about quitting, but we don't have a good set of interventions at this point to really help people. And that's what we're trying to look at.
We'll dig a little deeper into that in a bit, but I want to back up just a bit and ask why it's so hard to quit smoking.
Okay. It's really, really important that everybody understand, and I think everyone that's a smoker knows this, mm-hmm. but tobacco represents an addictive substance. It is highly addictive. It gets to your brain in 6 seconds or less, which makes it incredibly addictive from a pharmacokinetic perspective. Plus, it's something that people do over and over and over again. They have hundreds of learning trials of lifting a cigarette to their mouth. If you smoke a pack a day, then you're talking about somewhere between 200, 300 learning trials a day. And people learn to do it in all sorts of different settings. They learn to do it as a way to help them cope with feeling good or feeling bad. And I think that the addictive potential sometimes gets underestimated, and we go back to thinking that it's a bad habit.
Well, it sounds like it's both. It's a strong addiction and a habit, and it sounds like a lot of people would need to deal with both of those angles.
Absolutely. You need to deal with what we call with withdrawal symptoms. Mm-hmm. That's primarily what the medication is used to target. But you also need to deal with all the behaviors and all the components that go with smoking. Sometimes we even talk about cigarettes being like a friend and needing to sort of let go and even mourn the loss of something that was with you through getting your new job, through your breakup, through your stressors, and through your celebrations. And it is really learning how to live in a new way. And that's a real challenge for people.
And what's at stake? How big a health problem is smoking today in terms of long-term, maybe even short-term consequences?
So tobacco use is the leading preventable cause of death and morbidity in the United States. If we could get people to stop smoking, that would be the biggest preventive health intervention that we could do in the country and in the world. And so we're talking also not just about, sometimes smokers will say, well, you have to die of something, right? And we say, well, that's true, but are you willing to give up 10 years of life? On average, smokers don't just die of smoking-related diseases. They die considerably younger than non-smokers.
What have we learned so far leading up to where you are now about what really works and doesn't work from the doctor's office all the way up to public health campaigns and TV ads?
So we know when it comes to helping someone quit smoking, what we like to talk about is a 1-2 punch. We want to make sure that they've got the coaching that they need. That would include support, helping identify strategies for coping with urges or coping with times when you can't smoke. But we also want to provide the medications. There are nicotine replacement medications. There are also two different pills that are available, bupropion, which is also known as Wellbutrin or Zyban. And then there's Chantix, which is the generic name is varenicline. And all of those medications have been approved by the FDA and have been shown to double or triple your chances. And when you put the coaching together with the medication, that's the 1-2 punch. And evidence has shown that is your best chance of being able to quit.
Now, you mentioned how smokers know how hard it is to break this habit. I've heard in some cases that you try to quit and you fail. And you fear the next effort to quit. You worry that you just can't do it. You have failed mm-hmm. after that first effort. Where do you go from there?
Well, and that is a really hard place to be because people who are trying to quit smoking are giving it their very best shot, but it doesn't always work. And one of the things we try to talk to smokers about is when you haven't succeeded in a quit, when something has gotten you off track, you learn from it. You learn, probably the number one thing smokers learn is you can't have just one. You think, I've been quit for 3 weeks. I could just have one. It's a party. What's the problem? Well, you learn that your brain responds very fast when you put one more cigarette back in there. And so it really ends up leading most folks, in fact, more than 90% that have one, end up back at their full habit. But the other thing we have to talk about is the fact that every quit attempt is different. Just like every diet you go on is different, every time you try to make a behavior change, every time you try and tackle a big problem, where you are is different, what you know is different. And ideally, what we're trying to do in this research is give people some more tools through their primary care physicians to really help them be able to tackle this addiction.
Well, that sounds like it makes it really hard to research this because it may not be a one-size-fits-all. There may not be the one road to successfully quitting that's going to work for every single person.
Exactly right. And that is one of the things we're looking at in this research. Are certain medications more effective for others? Are certain kinds of coaching more effective for others? And part of the issue, and I think this comes into play when you're talking about getting services through a primary care setting, is there's not a simple script I can write for everybody. There's not a thing I can tell everybody, you know, oh, you get a cut, you wash it, you put antiseptic on it, and you protect it. That's pretty much the answer. With something like coaching, something that is very nuanced, that's very person-specific, sometimes those coaches very often have to be very specifically trained in how to deal with those individual issues that every smoker deals with as they try to quit.
One interesting angle to the project you're working on now, some people in the state anyway will have access to some kind of free support that they didn't previously?
Right. So what we're trying to do through this research is partner with different health systems. So UW Health, Aurora Health System, Dean Health System. And we're trying to work with these systems to actually integrate the treatment into primary care. Now, with the advent of the Affordable Care Act and other resources, more and more people are having access, but it's one of those things where you got to go find it. What we want to be able to do is if you go to the doctor's office, everybody should be being asked, are you a smoker? Then the next step should be if you say yes, are you interested in quitting? And if you are, here's what we can offer you right here, right now, while you're sitting, because sometimes you just got to jump on that moment when somebody says, you know, I didn't even think about it until you asked, but now that you asked, yes, I am. Or conversely, if somebody's sitting in your office and they say, are you kidding me? There's no way I could quit right now. rather than stopping the conversation, you keep it going by saying, well, all right, but maybe there's a little bit we could talk about it. Would you be interested in a program that might help you not quit? We're not going to push you to do that, but maybe cut down or just something so that you're ready and then we're ready to help you when you are ready to quit.
We're talking to Megan Piper. She's lead researcher at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, talking about the best practices for quitting smoking. The center was recently awarded $12 million from the NIH and National Cancer Institute to research the most effective ways to quit smoking.
And we'd like to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried to quit smoking? Were you successful or unsuccessful? And why do you think that happened? Do you have questions about the best way to quit? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Megan Piper, lead researcher at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. The center was recently awarded $12 million from the NIH and National Cancer Institute to research the most effective ways to quit smoking.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried to quit smoking? How'd it go? What made the difference, whether it worked or didn't? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Jim in Portage on the line now. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I tried quitting at least half a dozen times. I smoked for 35 years. Hypnotism, Chantix, gum, patch. What worked for me is they raised the prices so high, I just said the heck with it, and I quit cold turkey, and it's been over 5 years, and I continue to save $75 a week, and I use that money on other stuff, just fun stuff, and that's how I quit, and keeping it in the bank and saving it, that makes me quit, and best thing for me. Anyway, I got to run. Thanks.
Jim, thanks a lot. So emphasizing the cost savings there, is that a psychological message that makes a difference for people, Megan?
Oh, absolutely. You asked earlier about public health things that we can do, and increasing taxes and increasing the price of cigarettes is the number one public health intervention that we can use. It helps young people not start, and just like Jim, it can really motivate people to quit. And congratulations, Jim, 5 years, that's fabulous.
Yeah, and Jim said cold turkey was what ultimately worked. I don't know, how effective is cold turkey? And maybe it was those other five or six times before cold turkey that set him up to be able to do that?
Absolutely. You know, you can quit smoking cold turkey, and you're very right. Jim probably learned a lot about a lot of tricks, a lot of risks and pitfalls he needed to avoid when he was ready to quit. But we always talk about, if I sent you out to build a house, would I give you no tools, or would I give you just a hammer? No, I'd give you as many tools as I possibly could so you could build the best house possible. So if you're really interested in quitting, sometimes cold turkey works, but really to give yourself the best chances, again, that 1-2 punch, the medication if you can use it, and then the coaching or counseling.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Melissa on the line in Chippewa Falls. Melissa, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Melissa?
Well, I just want to say that I am a former smoker, 7 years now, and I too quit cold turkey, although I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, just as you guys were talking about. It really is a setup for failure, but I also am an addictions counselor. I work at a treatment center in Chippewa Falls, and we actually, in May of 2012, we incorporated tobacco dependency into our programming, so unlike most other treatment centers, we don't ignore tobacco dependency or just kind of let them smoke and, oh, they can quit one thing at a time. We actually address it right in, just like we would any other drug.
Melissa, thanks a lot for the call. So treating tobacco as an addiction is a point you brought up earlier, Megan.
Oh, excellent. And Melissa, I'm so glad to hear that. We've really been working hard in Wisconsin. We have a project called the WinTip Project, which is run through our center. And we're really trying to work hard to get addiction facilities, as well as facilities that work with folks with mental illness issues, to treat smokers. Because like you said, it is an addiction. And we used to think, oh, it's fine to continue smoking, get rid of all the other addictions. But I'll tell you now, what's going to kill you? The tobacco use. Right now, we know that people with addiction, other addictions, as well as mental illness, smoke more than half of the cigarettes produced in the United States.
Really?
This is an incredibly vulnerable population, and we sort of just let them continue smoking because we think it's the best thing for them. But I really struggle with the idea that the best coping response they could ever have is something that will kill them.
Thanks a lot for the call, Melissa. We've got Josh on the line now in West Bend. Josh, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. How did you quit, if you've tried?
Yeah, no, I did smoke for about 17 years, and I tried Chantix, the gum, that nicotine inhaler, about everything that you can get your hands on. But what actually did it for me was the e-cigarette. But it wasn't the e-cigarette that's the disposable one where you buy it from the gas station. It was actually, they referred to it as a mechanical mod. And it actually gave me the sensation of smoking a cigarette and was actually able to let me quit for now over a year.
Josh, congratulations. You were nodding when you described that mechanical mod. I don't know what that is, Megan.
Sure. So like Josh said, there are cigarettes that you can buy sort of mass produced in the, you know, gas station or whatever. But then there are something called tank systems or mod systems. And they're almost like little devices that you can play with. You can buy the different kinds of juice or nicotine liquid. You can flavor them. You can do different things like that. And so those tend to have larger batteries and produce more or allow you to inhale more of the nicotine when you're using that kind of electronic cigarette. And right now, you know, there's so little research on electronic cigarettes. They're not regulated at this point by the FDA, so we never know exactly what's in them when you use them. We do know that combustibles, so a cigarette, a traditional cigarette, has more than 7,000 chemicals, many of which are carcinogenic and health risks. We don't know always what's in e-cigarettes, but we know it's fewer than 7,000. So I'm really glad that Josh was able to quit using an e-cig. People always say, well, should you recommend e-cigs for people who want to quit? And what I say is the evidence shows that there are medications, there are coaching, there's some different kinds of coaching approaches that work well for people. And some people have stories that things like e-cigs work, and, you know, it worked for Josh, so that was great for him. It would not be the first thing I would recommend, but sometimes it's really effective.
Well, speaking of kind of newer technology, you're trying a new technological wrinkle kind of behind the scenes in this new project to help people quit smoking. What are you doing?
Right. So one of the things that we're trying to do is we integrate smoking treatment really into primary care and into the doctor's office is to use electronic health records. Now that more and more doctors' offices and hospitals and other health systems are going to electronic health records, when somebody says they're a smoker and they put that into the computer, that can right away pop up a reminder for whether it's the nurse or the medical assistant or even the physician treating the patient. Oh, this person's a smoker. What do I need to do to help treat the number one issue that's probably going to kill them? And it can be a prompt like, oh, connect them with somebody who has the time to give them the counseling they need. Or, oh, remind me to ask about this at the next visit. And so we're really trying to take full advantage of all of the treatment resources that we can and funnel them into the doctor and the provider's hands right in the clinic room using the EHR.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Bert on the line in La Crosse. Bert, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What's your story?
My story is last November, my youngest son and I were on our way to a hunting trip, and I bought a pack of cigarettes on the way out of town, lit my second cigarette, and he said, Dad, me and my girlfriend are going to get married, and we are going to have grandchildren. So I'd have a grandchild, he said, and I'd really like to see you around to enjoy your grandchild. So I hope this can help someone that is listening to this program.
Did that work for you, Bert? Did that motivate you to quit?
I have not had one since. I crushed that pack of cigarettes, and sad to say, I threw it out the window because I knew if I would have kept it, I probably would have tried to unfold one and smoke one.
Bert, thank you so much. Congratulations on quitting. That's a powerful motivation. You want to be around for your grandkids.
Absolutely. And it just speaks to the fact that sometimes there are those moments where you just think, that's it. I'm done. And you really, and Bert, obviously you capitalized on that. You could have had that moment and left the pack in the car and then forgot about it next time you got back in the car, but you didn't. You seized the moment when you felt that strong, I am done, no more, and tossed the cigarettes. You felt it and then you took the action. And what we want to do in this research is help people try and feel more of that yes, I am ready to quit, whether it's through the treatments that we're going to offer for people who aren't quite ready, or whether it's by offering a treatment in your clinic where you're familiar and letting people have a shot at quitting using those treatments.
Is there anything people out there in Wisconsin can do to get involved in this research project you've got going?
Not right now.
Okay.
This research is going to be recruited specifically through these different health systems that I referenced, Aurora, Dean, UW Health. So people in selected clinics will be going to the doctor, and when they do, they might be invited to participate. But unfortunately, this is not one that you can call in and ask to participate in.
Speaking of calling, do we still have that quit line here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. The quit line is another fabulous resource that every person in the state of Wisconsin can access. 1-800-QUIT-NOW, 866-QUIT-NOW. And what you can do is when you call, they're going to just talk you through trying to quit. They're going to coach you. They're going to help you identify the risk factors you might have, the things that might get in your way. They're going to offer you lots of support. And right now, the state of Wisconsin is paying for you to get 2 weeks of free nicotine patch or nicotine gum. So it really is a fabulous resource, and anybody can access that.
Megan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Megan Piper. She is assistant professor in the UW Department of Medicine, lead researcher at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, talking about a new project funded in part by the National Cancer Institute and the NIH to figure out what works best in helping people quit smoking. You can continue the conversation, by the way, at the Central Time Facebook page. It's been 5 days since the United States began its airstrikes against the Islamic State movement, also known as ISIS, in Iraq, in an attempt to help Kurds and others under assault by the group. The strikes have been highly targeted. The chance of the U.S. entering the conflict on the ground appears highly unlikely at this point.
Meanwhile, in Baghdad, Iraqi prime minister is in the early stages of forming a new government, and without a unified government, it will be difficult for Iraq to launch the kind of offensive needed to push ISIS out of the country. RAND Corporation political scientist and counterterrorism expert Patrick Johnston says that in the meantime, important steps should be taken to cut off ISIS's cash flow. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times today called Hitting ISIS Where It Hurts. Patrick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of attention right now is focused on efforts to aid religious minorities in Iraq in the north who are traveling to Kurdistan to escape ISIS. What do we know about their situation right now?
The situation is pretty dire, and this is why the president is considering a limited intervention that would involve U.S. Special Operations Forces or possibly British Special Operations Forces to mount essentially a hostage rescue mission that wouldn't be a reinvasion of Iraq, but instead it would be focused on opening up the roads in and out of the area where the hostages are being held on Mount Sinjar.
And journalists are commenting on the large numbers of women and children and older people. So once they reach Kurdistan, how safe are they?
So they're less safe than they were even, say, 2 weeks ago. And the reason why is because the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, has expanded its control into those areas. And so over the weekend, ISIS expanded into Kurdistan and has been threatening Erbil, the kind of main center of Kurdistan, and then has managed to form basically the kind of foundations of an Islamic state in those areas where it seeks to impose control. So a top priority for the United States, along with protecting the Kurdish people, is to essentially push ISIS back out of those parts of Kurdistan and back into the areas it had previously controlled in northern Iraq.
How successful would you say that the airstrikes have been so far?
So far, the airstrikes appear to have had some success. There were reports of some top ISIS leaders being killed in the airstrikes. But I think the more important kind of thing that the airstrikes do is to limit the freedom of movement that ISIS has. So when ISIS was facing effectively no serious resistance from Iraqi security forces under the Maliki government, and the Kurdish militia were, which have historically had fairly good capabilities for self-defense and also for offensive operations, but they had also been overwhelmed. And so the airstrikes have helped limit the freedom of movement that ISIS has to essentially deploy its fighters sort of in places and times of its choosing, and this helps the other security forces, both the Iraqis and the Kurds, to regroup and to be able to try to reclaim those areas that ISIS is now controlling.
Well, let's talk about the Iraqi government. Now, the U.S. wants Iraq to establish a new cabinet. Prime Minister al-Maliki has been resistant. And as far as the U.S. is concerned, what is the goal for a new Iraqi government?
The goal for a new Iraqi government is I think, one that is more inclusive. So a lot of the problems that Iraq is now facing with the humanitarian crisis, the resurgence of ISIS, the sectarian politics, much of that has its roots in kind of the development of the Maliki government, so a Shia-dominated government that was really exclusionary after particularly after the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2012, but even there were some kind of signs of this before then, of the Maliki government playing favorites with the Shia in the country, not keeping promises that it had made to the Sunni tribes that had revolted against, at the time it was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is ISIS is the new incarnation of. And so a more inclusive government in Baghdad would stem, stop some of the sectarian politics, which are driving more Sunnis who were formerly enemies of ISIS, who have since become essentially allies of ISIS in this war against the Maliki government because they've been excluded from Iraqi politics, to essentially form a government that will help turn all of those parties against ISIS and then stem the security threat and hopefully build a more sustainable, inclusive Iraq.
So let's say that we have this new inclusive government in the 30 days that the U.S. wants it in. What are the first actions that should be taken?
Well, the first actions that should be taken are, I think, security sector reform. And what I mean by that is specifically actions that will help kind of build on some of the training and equipment that the U.S. provided before it withdrew from Iraq to the Iraqi security forces. There was an extensive U.S. Mission and kind of component to the war that wasn't really war fighting, but it was essentially preparing Iraqi security forces to be able to stand up and clear, hold, and build sort of the counterinsurgency mantra, but to be able to do this on their own when the U.S. would no longer be there. That much has failed so far, and the reason why, I think many people in Washington think is because of this sort of political dynamic that has kind of ripped the country apart at the seams, and that's included the security services. So, so reforming the security services would ideally, put Sunnis, Shias next to each other in a balance that would be effective against ISIS, which is still really an existential threat to the Iraqi government, to the Syrian government next door, possibly to other governments in the region. And down the road, it's not impossible that it could be a threat to the U.S. homeland. So I think that's the first goal. And the administration has purposefully set political reform in front of kind of security sector reform, and or a direct intervention by U.S. forces, because without a political solution, a military solution or victory would be short-lived over ISIS, no matter how many fighters were captured or killed, so on. The group is very resilient, and there has to be kind of a unified front that would fight against them, that would include both Shia, Sunnis, and as well as Kurds in the north.
Well, with U.S. ground involvement on the ground sort of off the table as far as the United States goes, you think we should be looking at the financial standpoint. So what can the U.S. do to choke off the funding for ISIS?
So the U.S. could do a few things, and I think that this is a particularly important issue and possible policy option for the U.S., given that it's committed not to commit troops to go and conduct combat operations in Iraq. And so essentially what this would look like would be deployment of civilian advisors from a variety of U.S. government agencies, including, I think, Treasury, the FBI, perhaps, and other government agencies who were deployed to Iraq during the U.S. period of the war and developed fairly sophisticated law enforcement and investigative capabilities, essentially to collect financial intelligence that would help first, I think, paint kind of an intelligence picture of ISIS and where its money is coming from, right? It's the richest terrorist group in the world now.
Well, where is its money coming from?
So the money comes primarily from internal sources and primarily from local economies in the north of the country, particularly in and around the city of Mosul. And so it's a different model from other terrorist groups that the U.S. government has been more familiar with and has expended a lot more attention and energy countering, like Al-Qaeda, for example, which drew most of its money prior to 9/11 from Gulf state donors, wealthy Saudis, Qataris, and allegedly from some governments as well. So ISIS is different, and it's established more of kind of a mafia state in the north and around Mosul. And so to counter ISIS, the strategy requires a very localized, granular picture of what their network looks like, not just in terms of how it conducts attacks and what its political ambitions are, but how it interfaces with local business owners and extorts essentially protection money in its protection rackets, its control of the oil fields or its intimidation of the oil sector essentially and extraction of revenue that way. And so it's a different model and playbook that's necessary to stop essentially the flow of money that's coming into ISIS, which is funding so many of its attacks. And we really see that through actually past research that I and other RAND colleagues have done, is very closely linked to the money and the attacks are very closely linked. And so reducing the amount of money that the group has should kind of commensurately reduce its ability to conduct attacks and to keep conducting the kind of grisly operations that it's been conducting so successfully to take large swaths of northern Iraq.
And we've got to leave it there. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Patrick Johnston, counterterrorism expert at the RAND Corporation, about the current U.S. campaign against ISIS in Iraq.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Writer June Melby tells us everything that's wrong with Wisconsin.
The state of Wisconsin looks like a hand. Hold up your right palm, stick out your thumb, and lo, you have Door County, a thumb-shaped peninsula of tourism lapping into Lake Michigan, where summertime visitors can drive on crowded roads and buy cherry pies, cherry liqueurs, cherry-painted shot glasses, and stay at overpriced cherry-themed motels. At the top of your hand, between your extended fingers, in the northernmost part of the state, sprawl lakes and rivers and other water-soaked lands, generally too overrun with mosquitoes to be habitable except by extremists. I have heard that religious monks in Italy would slap leather whips across their backs until they bled, believing pure suffering could bring them closer to God. Or you could just spend some time in northern Wisconsin, say 5 to 7 minutes. The suffering is the same, the insects more skilled at drawing your blood. Across the center of the state and the palm of your hand are the fertile plains, fields of corn and alfalfa, glowing soybeans, and pastures of slow-moving cows. These are separated into farms by dots of broken-down silos, collapsing barns, and graying farmhouses. The winter is long and the climate absurd. No paint sticks to the sides of these buildings. As you drive up Highway 22, you can play the game Abandoned House, Not Abandoned House, looking for signs of human life between abundant fields of abundant grains. Also, abundant fields of geometrically correct trees. In Wisconsin, the trees grow in tidy columns. Red pine, red pine, red pine, row after row after row, like corn instead of trees. The forests here appeal mostly to people who like their wilderness organized, who admire the beauty of crossword puzzles. Along the roadside, like wildflowers, are the carcasses of freshly killed deer. They bloom red and white and brown all year long. I'm telling you this so that you will stay away. Don't go to Wisconsin. You might think I'm joking, but I'm not joking. There is a problem with Wisconsin. The lakes. They are a little too beautiful. The water a little too crystal clear. And if people find out, will they all come here? Will we have to, you know, share it with them? I like sharing. Generally speaking, I was raised Lutheran. I understand the Christian way. And besides, my parents had a tourism business, a hand-built miniature golf course in the backyard on the chain of lakes in Waupaca. If we didn't get visitors, we wouldn't get business. So clearly, I have mixed feelings about this. But nature requires a certain amount of tranquility. In Wisconsin, when you push off in the canoe, great blue herons take off into the sky. Turtles and minnows swim underneath you, and the reflection of the clouds and the blue sky above. When you look out across the surface, you can wonder if the lake is not a body of water at all, but perhaps a second sky that lies closer to the earth. It's just it's terrible. Have I mentioned the wood ticks? They will suck the blood right out of you. Don't go to Wisconsin. No.
June Melby is a teacher, performer, and the author of My Family and Other Hazards. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org or look for Wisconsin Life on Facebook.
Right here in Wisconsin on the UW-Madison campus, researchers are hard at work developing the engine of the future, one that could eventually end up in your new car.
Our next guest is one of those researchers. His latest project could be a game changer. His team is developing a technology they're integrating into a diesel engine with a twist, the result being an engine that's 10 to 15% more efficient than anything currently on the road, with some additional benefits as well.
We're joined right now in studio by Ralph Reitz. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison. Ralph, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So as I understand it, the system we're working on, it has a complicated name. I'm going to let you tell us what RCCI is and how it works.
So it stands for Reactivity Controlled Compression Ignition. And it's a variant of a technology that was also actually explored at the University of Wisconsin maybe 30 years ago called homogeneous charge compression ignition, which is HCCI. And we've got a twist on that, calling it RCCI.
I see. So what makes this engine different?
So what makes it different is that we can operate with low temperature combustion. Low temperature combustion is kind of the one of the desired features of the combustion process, because it emits lower amounts of nitric oxide, which is a smog-producing pollutant from combustion engines. And at the same time, we've developed a method of making it soot-free, or in other words, without the particulates that you would see from a diesel engine or an older diesel engine without after-treatment.
Now, how do you get rid of the soot?
So what we do is we operate the engine very well mixed. In other words, the fuel is introduced into the combustion chamber early in the compression stroke, so that by the time combustion starts, you don't have rich or fuel-rich pockets of fuel, which is really the source of unburnt fuel and particulates or soot.
And in terms of what exactly goes into this engine, it's not just diesel and it's not just gasoline. You've got a little of both. And this is something that's a bit new, isn't it?
That's correct. So we call it reactivity controlled. And the reason for that is that gasoline, surprisingly, is actually a very unreactive fuel. And it requires a spark plug to ignite it in general. Whereas diesel is a much more reactive fuel, not requiring a spark plug, but instead just it will ignite under compression. So by blending these two fuels together, what we can do is arrange that the diesel fuel essentially times the combustion process, and the gasoline fuel determines how long the combustion process occurs. So having that extra degree of freedom allows you to really optimize the combustion process.
And you're doing road tests on this already, right?
That's right. So we did the preliminary work actually with computer modeling. Then we went to single cylinder research engines, then multi-cylinder engines like in your car. And then finally, we've implemented it in a vehicle. And we are undergoing tests right now. This is an electric hybrid car with a diesel engine that's been adapted to have two fuels, gasoline and diesel.
What was that process like, getting the engine fitted and installed into this? I guess it's a 2009 Saturn.
That's correct. It was a wonderful opportunity for our students because we covered the whole range, all the way from, you know, the math of computer modeling all the way to a practical vehicle and getting it running on the road. We've had it tested also at the Oak Ridge National Labs on their chassis dynamometers and also at Ford. So this has been an exciting project involving, you know, undergraduate and graduate students at the Engine Research Center.
Looking for clean, efficient functioning is the holy grail here. How clean and efficient is this new version?
So there's another thing that you have to account for, and that's cost. Currently, to clean up the exhaust, say, on a diesel engine, can cost almost as much as the engine itself with the requirement of special after-treatment technologies. With this approach, we don't need those after-treatment systems to the same extent as is needed in, say, a diesel truck or a diesel car. And this reduces the cost of the engine significantly. So we can meet the federally mandated, EPA mandated emission regulations without the need for expensive after-treatment. In addition to that, we see these fuel economy benefits where the engine operation is 15% or so more efficient than a diesel engine and way more efficient than a gasoline engine. We're talking, you know, maybe 50% improvement over a gasoline engine.
That's quite something. So if this thing is in not just Saturns but other vehicles, what is it going to change?
Well, you may be familiar with the President Obama's initiative to create a 54.5 mile per gallon standard for cars by 2025. This vehicle, we've already demonstrated, can do 50 miles per gallon, and that's just with our preliminary demonstration runs and so on here at the university without teams of, you know, development engineers as you would find at a car company.
Ralph, I want one of these in my car. How long is it going to take?
Well, you know, the industry is, first of all, you have to remember when you buy a car, typically you keep one for 10 years or so before you think about buying a new one. So it takes a long time to phase in a new concept. We are working to try to get this as one of the alternatives that is being explored by the automotive companies. So we have participation of a consortium of company members who are all looking at the technology. We're hoping that it will be competitive against some of the other options, which are, we think, much more expensive and not as efficient.
Well, congratulations on your engine. I wish you luck.
Thank you very much.
That was Ralph Reitz. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at UW-Madison, talking about his new combustion engine, more efficient and cleaner.